In the coming week, the anniversary of the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre is marked amid a surge in Hong Kong tensions. The European Union debates a massive coronavirus rescue plan, and the Atlantic hurricane season begins. It's May 28th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Sebastian Malaby, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Sebastian is CFR's Paul A. Volcker Senior Fellow for International Economics, and he's joining us today from London. But in these remote working days, he could be anywhere. But Sebastian, wherever you are, it's great to have you back.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Bob. This coming June the 4th marks the 31st anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. This anniversary, of course, is felt deeply by the Hong Kong protesters. Last year, the protesters organized a massive candlelit vigil to memorialize the 30th anniversary of what happened in Tiananmen Square. But it's pretty hot out there right now, Bob. Catch us up, please. What's the tone of what's happening today?
Yeah, it certainly is pretty hot. I mean, Tiananmen Square will just be yet another inflection point, the anniversary, for what it looks to be a rolling series of protests following one move after another from the central authorities in Beijing. The rubber stamp parliament of the Chinese Communist government, as expected, overwhelmingly passed a national security law that will basically make a lot of the freedoms that Hong Kongers have enjoyed under the One Country, Two Systems agreement no longer possible, because all sorts of justifications can be made for cracking down on protests for national security reasons. This has created quite a pall over Hong Kong. One of the effects, even before the parliament voted, but when this law was tabled, was a comment from the U.S. Secretary of State that the U.S. would no longer consider Hong Kong as an autonomous territory, and that triggers all sorts of possible changes to U.S. policy towards Hong Kong. Now, just as a reminder, unlike mainland China, Trump administration's tariffs and other measures against China do not apply to Hong Kong. Hong Kong gets, because of its special status, gets special treatment. At this point, it is one of the world's major financial hubs. There is a great deal of concern among people who support that the status of Hong Kong, that this movement by China is going to do away with that. And that was always one of the threats posed if it made such a move. But there's certainly a feeling in the air that China doesn't care anymore. And it's worried enough about what it sees as sedition by Hong Kong activists that it is going to seize the reins and start to roll back the agreement that went into effect in 1997.
Bob, do you think that the Beijing government is choosing this moment to crack down because it's simply responding to the protests on the ground in Hong Kong? Or is it something to do with the geopolitical environment created by COVID-19 in the sense that the U.S. is not in a fit state to push back?
I think there's probably element of both of those, Sebastian. Certainly, we have come through a significant year in protests in Hong Kong after a more minor move, but still significant move by the central authorities to try to extradite Hong Kong residents to the mainland was fought vehemently. And basically, the central government backed down on that last year. The huge protests, one of them, I think, totaled almost 2 million people at one point. And there were protests all over the place. They were audacious. And they really signified that Hong Kong residents were tenaciously holding on to their freedoms and to a sense of democracy. I think you were already looking at what was going to be a difficult year between Beijing and Hong Kong activists. Now you have, potentially under the cover of fighting against the coronavirus pandemic, the authorities sort of seizing the moment, as other authoritarian countries and some democratic ones have done, to roll back freedoms. Now, as it is, as we went to tape this podcast, I believe that they're still, we're going to forbid any sort of commemorations of the Tiananmen Square anniversary in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong has always been unique among any Chinese territory for being able to mark that anniversary up through last year, which is the 30th anniversary. This year, they're not going to be allowed to under public health laws, although political activists say it was just a shield for suppressing yet another opportunity for people to express their views and to protest. So I think, Sebastian, the authorities are seeing a ripe moment to come in and do this. And then I think it's a big test, although we've had this declaration now by Secretary of State Pompeo about Hong Kong's autonomy. It remains to be seen what the U.S. will do about that. Will the U.S. come forward then, follow through, and potentially, for example, target sanctions against Chinese officials in response to their moves in putting forward a national security law, or threaten to do that? There's all sorts of U.S.-China tensions across the board. obviously, a central triggering aspect is tensions over the way this coronavirus played out from its origins in Wuhan. U.S. officials saying the Chinese were not forthcoming in what was going on, and they are to blame for the spread, which has hit the U.S. particularly hard. And so, you know, there's any number of places where you're seeing confrontations playing out. The question is whether the U.S. and other standard bearers of Hong Kong's democracy, let's say in Europe, will come out and back the, at least fight and forcefully argue in favor of the 30-year agreement that is supposed to retain rule of law in Hong Kong.
It's sort of always a bit risky to extrapolate from one's direct observations when they are sort of, you know, just a moment. But I did take an interesting trip last November where I went to Beijing, Shanghai, and Hong Kong. And here's why it was interesting and maybe relevant to what we're seeing now. When I was in Hong Kong, which was the last stop on the trip, it was at a point when there was supposedly a lull in the protests, but actually the protests heated up right when I was there. And so I was visiting various financial leaders, including the head of one of the local banks, and we had an elegant lunch on the, I don't know, the 50th floor of his skyscraper or whatever level we were at. And at the end, one of the people I'd gone with, who was sort of showing me around a bit, came downstairs and looked in horror at the ground floor of his bank, where normally there are big glass windows facing out onto the street. But these had been shuttered with steel barricades, and you could see and smell the tear gas wafting down past the one small door that was open. And he was saying, "This is not the Hong Kong I grew up in. This is not the Hong Kong I know." And so there was a sense that for this banker, you know, the very fundamentals of the kind of rule of law stability that made financial trading possible in Hong Kong was being undermined. But the flip side of this trip was when I was in Shanghai and Beijing, and particularly Shanghai, where you get a sense of the business beat more, there's nothing but bullishness, nothing but excitement about how, you know, China's developed this incredible venture capital industry that's funding new technology businesses left and right. And the one thing I wonder about is whether the timing of the government's crackdown, not in the specifics, but sort of generally the willingness to do it despite the threatened sanctions from the US, is because in some sense, over the last 20 years, China has come to need Hong Kong less. It's developed its own onshore international cities with, you know, like Shanghai and Shenzhen and so forth. Those cities have their own financial markets. You know, there's an attempt to internationalize the renminbi. Onshore Chinese government bond trading has become a big deal, with a lot of foreigners owning Chinese government bonds, which are traded on the mainland, not in Hong Kong. And so I wonder whether Hong Kong, in a sense, is less essential to China's strategy economically and therefore more vulnerable politically.
That's a really good point. And I think there's certainly one line of analysis that is saying China's made the calculation and decided that it's in a position where it can do this with, you know, reduced or minimalized pain on the economic front. And it's also really, you know, bringing it back towards the U.S. calculations, which I think are going to be really interesting to watch, is, you know, is this something where the U.S. is more inclined ultimately to follow the sentiment of the business tycoon that you were quoting, or, you know, the Joshua Wong type activists who's standing for the democratic aspirations of a free Hong Kong? And, you know, part of this is also this struggle that continues to go on, many would say is a losing struggle in the Trump administration, between those who want to make democratic promotion, or at least the defense of human rights and democracy and rule of law, you know, a pillar of U.S. foreign policy, versus those who say it has to be subsumed by other considerations. And will, at the end of the day, the Trump administration take tough steps against China, maybe not for an economic consideration, but political ones? This is a political year, obviously. China is being held up as a major issue between the Trump campaign and the expected Democratic nominee, Joe Biden. And so maybe politics wins out on it. It's going to be really interesting to see. And things are going to get really hot and heavy this summer, I think, Sebastian. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to take us, Sebastian, over to the European continent, because there's quite a lot going on there as well. There is actually an epic rescue plan in the offing related to the coronavirus setbacks. And some say it could actually be, you know, a pivotal moment for the EU experiment and laying the foundation for a more centralized way of approaching such a problem and approaching bailouts for countries and so forth. Can you tell us more about what we're looking at in the week ahead in terms of the EU rescue plan?
Yes, sure. Well, what's happened is that the European Commission, which is sort of the executive branch of the European Union, has proposed a COVID-19 rescue plan to address some of the economic fallout from the coronavirus crisis. And one point about this is that it's going to be 750 billion euros, which is a big sum of money. But that's actually not the most interesting thing, because although that is big, it's not bigger than the sort of fiscal stimuluses that we've seen in the US, in Britain. If you look at it as a share of GDP, you know, all countries have come out with extremely large budget responses, deficit spending, as well as extremely large central bank interventions. In fact, I have an essay which I'll quickly flag for listeners coming out in Foreign Affairs tomorrow, Friday, which is about sort of the age of magic money, the kind of creation of enormous amounts of money essentially printed by central banks to rescue economies, and the way that this is sort of like A, broken all bounds, and B, is a sort of new authority exercised in different degrees in different countries. So you may have some differentiation of which countries can exploit this new magic money the most. But going back to Europe, the thing that's striking, therefore, is not so much the amount, although it's big, it's that it's going to be financed, at least this is the plan, by issuing Central European Union bonds. So normally, the European Commission has a budget, it's pretty small, and it's financed by grants from the member states who raise taxes and then transfer a sliver of those taxes to the central authority in the European Commission. This time, the European Commission is going to go to the bond market, issue bonds, raise the money, spend the money, and then have to repay those bonds by raising European Commission taxes. And so this does a couple of things to the structure of Europe in economic terms. One is that suddenly there are tax revenues being paid straight directly to the European Commission, as opposed to tax revenues flowing to the German government or the French government, and then some fraction being passed along to Brussels. So this emergence of the central executive branch of the pan-European structure being a taxing authority, that's new. And there's talk, for example, of taxing plastics on environmental grounds, or maybe digital commerce, but whatever they tax, that will be a sort of precedent-setting change. And the other thing is that issuing a central bond is new, right? Before, the German government issued bonds, the Italian government issued bonds, each government was on the hook to repay its own bonds, and there was no burden sharing, although that was fudged a bit by the behavior of the European Central Bank. Politically, there was no willingness to share the burden. And so, although there have been proposals before for centrally issued eurobonds coming from France, coming from Italy, the German government has always refused outright. And in fact, what's remarkable politically about this new move is that as recently as the start of the COVID-19 crisis around March, there was a big argument about corona bonds. And, you know, the French led a coalition of about seven countries in the European Union saying that there should be corona bonds centrally issued. And the Germans just said, that's not a realistic proposal. So something has changed in Germany. Angela Merkel's government has come around to the other side. And Ursula von der Leyen, the German who is the head of the European Commission and an ally of Chancellor Merkel's, has come out with her proposal. So both the federal government in Germany and its ally in Brussels are pushing in the same direction. There is still, though, some resistance to this from a group of countries who are known as the Frugal Four. That's Austria, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Sweden. And they strongly resistant to the idea of centralizing budgetary authority and issuing bonds, and they're fighting a rearguard action. And it remains to be seen exactly how that plays out.
Does this type of decision require that every single country to sign on, or is there consensus that will move it forward?
That is a great question. My understanding is that in order to get this particular plan through, you don't need every country to sign on. There is no right of veto, nor do you need a treaty change or whatever. It can be done if a consensus is achieved, and it doesn't quite have to be a unanimous consensus. So the political betting I'm seeing is that although there are these four countries which are making protest, they counter-propose, for example, that rather than giving grants to hard-hit regions of Europe from this pot of money, there should be just loans. The consensus is that because Germany has switched sides and is not supporting the Frugal Four, that the Frugal Four are going to have to fold.
It's fascinating because obviously, as you've indicated, it's been such an article of faith for Germany not to go this route and to be leading the charge against this type of approach. And yet either the scope of the pandemic, the long-term scope, or something has spooked them or has persuaded them enough that this is the way to go.
a big point here is that whereas the debt crisis in Europe in the past decade with, you know, the Greeks and the Italians and Spanish and so forth, having either had a government that borrowed way too much or a private sector that, you know, borrowed too much and then had to be bailed out by the government, either way, you wound up with excess debt creating a sudden financial crisis. And the German response to that was, you shouldn't have borrowed all that money in the first place. Don't expect us to rescue you when you made the mistake.
Right, the moral hazard argument.
Exactly. But when it's coronavirus coming out of left field or coming out of China, whichever way you want to put it, there is no sort of moral case against helping. And I think for Angela Merkel, that might weigh quite heavily. And so that's why the response this time is different. And why, you know, in theory, this is a sort of one-off thing where you have a kind of common challenge, which is going to be met with common debt. The question is, if you do it once, aren't you setting a precedent? Aren't you showing
that
it's possible to have common debt? And once you do that, the precedent might be repeated again in the future.
Okay, so we'll get a clear sense then next week on if this is going forward.
Yes, I want to turn to something next, though, Bob, on your side of the pond, which is the beginning of the Atlantic hurricane season. We talked about crises coming out of left field.
Why doesn't your side of the pond get more storms than my side of the pond, Sebastian? That's what I want to know.
Destiny. Okay. I don't know. Anyway, there have been two major storms, Tropical Storm Arthur and Tropical Storm Bertha, already in the news before we even get to June the 1st. And many are already predicting that this year's hurricane season could potentially be one of the most devastating in history. So what's going on here, Bob?
Yeah, this is uppermost in my mind as I sit in the humid, drizzly residue of Bertha here in Northern Virginia. These storms that you mentioned, Arthur and Bertha, actually jumped the queue. They came earlier than normal, which in itself is a new trend and something that climate watchers say is becoming kind of a new normal, which is that the hurricane season, maybe June 1st is too late to be the official start. And it should be a little bit earlier than that. Predictions have been that if you're seeing storms this early, we could have as many as 20 or so what they call name storms. So, you know, Arthur, Bertha, on through the alphabet. So 20 or so named storms this year, as opposed to a typical hurricane season of about 12 named storms. And some of those storms, let's say a third or a quarter of them, yield hurricanes. And that's where things get really dicey, especially in this age of extreme climate, where we've seen some hurricanes over the last few years that have been incredibly powerful and just leveled, whether you're talking about the Bahamas or sort of Gulf Coast towns in the U.S. continent. So it's always a matter of concern. I think hurricane season is watched with ever more trepidation. Puerto Rico is another place that was hammered recently by a strong storm. There's also flooding that's increased quite a bit as a result of these storms. So it's always been something that storm watchers have watched to try to get a sense of what the coming year is like. Of course, on top of this all, the U.S. is still going to be dealing, and these Middle Atlantic states and the southern ones in particular, are dealing with the major fallout of the pandemic. And one of the agencies that's helping them try to deal with that is FEMA. And FEMA is the U.S. government agency that's also usually one of the first on the scene to help stand up, you know, refugee centers or centers where people can get housing when their own houses have been flattened, or, you know, doing things like opening up large facilities, stadiums, school gyms, whatever. All that kind of clustering of people is not, if required, is going to be there's going to be a different playbook, I think, this year. It's going to add further stress to the emergency response in the U.S. So we have yet another thing to worry about as we continue to try to respond in our state-by-state fashion in the U.S. to the pandemic.
Bob, do you have in the U.S. the expression shelter in place?
We do indeed.
So yes. You're talking now about shelter, even if you're displaced?
We'll have to coin a new one, a new term for that. Yeah. Sheltering in displacement. It's going to be a sheltering in social displacement. It's interesting. You've seen, it's been one of the more tragic photos emerging from the early rounds of the coronavirus epidemic, which is that, you know, all the homeless people, they've moved them from shelters to other places where they've been sort of carved out sleeping spots 6 feet apart or whatever. And you see these pictures of like these circles, you know, painted onto the floor of certain big centers or whatever, and then you have these homeless people who are there. Well, you could see this scenario play out under the storm scenario. So it's, again, as I say, it's creating a whole new set of, whole new type of planning that the government, you know, is usually equipped for on a typical hurricane season. But given what we've already seen now and given the compounding effect of health crisis and another kind of natural disaster, it's going to be another kind of tough summer, I think.
One thing I wonder about, Bob, just on this, is that the normal response to a hurricane is presumably, quite a chunk of it is simply private. I mean, people on their own accord pack their vehicles up and drive away and go stay with somebody, or they rent a room in a hotel or whatever they do. I mean, people don't necessarily have the resources to do that right now.
No, that's a really good point. And, you know, what are the hotel facilities like? You know, whether if you have the resources, are there going to be the number of hotels available to people? Even like, you know, when it's come up as far as where I live in Middle Atlantic and Virginia, it's usually not so much the destructive power of a storm, but maybe just the storm knocking out electrical power. And so people don't have generators, whatever, will, you know, kind of seek out, take a drive and hit a hotel that does, and they can get air conditioning, whatever. You know, those types of things, as mundane as they sound, it might not be available as well. So it's a whole new game this year, Sebastian. And I'm sure there's all sorts of planning going on, again, in our state-by-state fashion, but this is one area where the country actually tends to pull together and respond vigorously, but I think it's been really taxed. So there's a bit of concern.
So we've had the plague, we've had the, you know, the storms, where we're looking for the locust next.
Well, let's hope the locusts that are in Africa sort of peter out on some ocean voyage as they have in the past, because that's the last thing we need. All right, Sebastian, we've come to the part of the podcast where we talk about figures of the week. So who or what is your figure this week?
Bob, I couldn't resist choosing Dominic Cummings, who is the political strategist who's worked closely with the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. He's been at the center of a political row. I didn't use the word scandal, but row, that has cost the British government quite some credibility, because it turns out he did not obey the social distancing guidelines as the government itself presented them. In particular, at a time when people were told that they could go out for a walk for exercise, but they were not allowed to drive to get to the walk, he drove with his wife to a local beauty spot. And then he claims that this was necessary to test his eyesight, which has occasioned much ridicule in the press.
So is it an essential trip?
Well, no, it was not an essential trip. And indeed, the police have come out today with a statement saying that this was a violation, albeit a minor violation. But still, had he been discovered driving with his wife to this beauty spot, which is a sort of at an ancient castle, I think, he would have been told to go back home. He was not meant to do that. Now, he wouldn't have been fined, much less arrested, but he would have been told to go back home. And if he obeyed that, he would have been let off without a punishment. Nonetheless, it was against the rule. And it's not so much that, you know, he endangered somebody else by violating social distancing or anything like that. It's simply that there is an element, first of all, of hypocrisy in being a key figure in a government which has plastered, you know, poster boards and so forth in London with messages like, stay home, save lives. It's pretty direct stuff.
And a government whose prime minister was hospitalized with COVID-19.
Yeah, and in fact, Mr. Cummings himself had COVID-19 a little bit before this drive he went on. And separately, he had gone all the way with his family, including his four-year-old child, from London, about 260 miles, to a second home in the north of England to shelter. And he'd done that at a time when I think his wife had the virus and he had symptoms coming, or maybe it was the other way around. But in any case, they were motivated to get out of London because they realized they were getting sick. So it's just, you know, Mr. Cummings has managed to channel the anger of the ordinary British citizen against the corrupt elites of London with double standards and a sense of entitlement. And now he himself is looking as if he has double standards and a sense of entitlement, in that he doesn't have to follow the rules that he himself helped to put in place.
Does this in any way affect his livelihood, his trajectory, or the government's at this point?
Well, you know, a key thing was whether Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, would come out and stand by him. There was a very good political case for the Prime Minister to cut him loose. Mr. Cummings is not an elected official. He is simply an appointed advisor with not much of a formal role, but a very important informal influence. And so it would have been easy just to say, you know, you're fired. And in fact, several members of the Conservative Party in Parliament who have been inundated with angry letters from their constituents have come out and said they wish he did go, and that either he should be fired or he should resign, but really it's not appropriate for him to continue. So there's been a considerable amount of pressure on Mr. Cummings to go, but he has toughed it out, and so far the Prime Minister has stuck with him. And I guess their calculation is that under the British system, you know, they had an election in late 2019. They don't have to face the electorate again for another 4 and a bit years. And so what public opinion may feel for now is not too important. They can tough it out. And Mr. Cummings was central in winning the Brexit referendum for the Leave side, and again central in winning a very big majority for Boris Johnson in the election last year. So maybe his political smarts, although they deserted him in this particular case, are valuable enough that the Prime Minister will stick with him.
All right. Never a dull moment, seemingly, in pre-Brexit or almost Brexit London.
Bob, who or what is your figure of the week?
So, Sebastian, my figure is a number. It is the number 14, or it could be the number 15. But bottom line is, this is the amount of Russian military aircraft estimated by U.S. military officials to now be in Libya in the support of the warlord Khalifa Haftar. And this raises a number of concerns in many quarters about the trajectory of the Libyan conflict, including the specter of Libya, which has already been beset with civil war nearly 10 years now, approaching something like Syria status, where factional and bitter fighting intensifies such that you have some of the misery on the scale of Syria, which is everybody wants to avoid, including the UN, which has an arms embargo in Libya, and which Russia, which sits on the Security Council as a permanent member, seems to be violating. The Russians, as has been their pattern, have denied this, but there are, at the very least, according to reports from the scene, Russian mercenaries have been active in the area. And some say that Russian craft, including MiG aircraft, have been painted to try to disguise their Russian origin. It's going to be worth watching as well, because Turkey has taken a stepped up role in supporting Haftar's opponents, the government, the UN recognized government in Libya. And so I just note this figure because it's sort of the further internationalization of the Libyan war at a time when the region and the world can ill afford another divisive such conflict, and the Security Council itself appears to be hapless in doing anything about it.
Do you think that could change? Could the Security Council get its act together?
Given the pattern of the Security Council, and certainly with Syria as an example, it's doubtful. Some of this, again, as always, depends on if the U.S. decides to make a fight of it. There are other countries, other permanent members, however, in the Security Council that are very concerned, such as the French, who have been trying to also bring about peace in Libya and have clear sides. They have warned about a Syria scenario taking place in Libya. So you could see more stepped up action and diplomatic initiatives by the French. And, you know, Libya being an oil-rich country, even as oil prices continue to almost bottom out at this point, Libya is strategically important for a number of reasons. So you could still see the Security Council as an arena for scuffling over this. The UN has, through it thick and thin, you know, still emerged as kind of one of the lead brokers here, but it's looking pretty dicey at the moment. And again, without a strong player in the Security Council to help guide this forward, which has traditionally been the US, it could devolve further.
Well, that's something to watch. And I guess that wraps it up. That's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The SpaceX astronaut launch, which was originally postponed because of poor weather, is scheduled to take place. Chilean President Sebastián Piñera delivers an annual speech to Congress. And the World Trade Organization General Council meets in Geneva.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave a review while you're at it. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. This week, our recording engineer was also Zoe Collis. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero, licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Sebastian Malaby saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying thanks so much, Sebastian, for joining us. And everyone, stay safe out there.